This is our continuing coverage in the trial of Shanda Vander Ark, a twisted story of a mother who depraved her own child of food until the point of death, even employing her oldest son in this torturous charade. We now take you to the courtroom for our continuing coverage.
3110 FC, People versus Shanda Vander Ark. Are you Shanda Vander Ark, ma'am?
Yes, sir.
All right. Ms. Vander Ark is represented today by Mr. Johnson. Mr. Roberts is here on behalf of the people of the state of Michigan. This is day two of a jury trial. Records reflect that the jury is assembled in the jury room. Secure. Anything before we bring out the jury, Mr. Roberts?
I don't believe so.
All right. And Mr. Johnson?
No, sir.
All right. And just to verify for the record, we had discussed the proposed preliminary jury instructions. Any corrections or changes to those before we read those to the jury and then bring them out? Mr. Roberts and Mr. Johnson?
No, sir.
All right. Mr. Weaver, go ahead and bring the jury out. Please rise.
As soon as you get to your seat, you can sit down. We're actually standing for you. So as soon as you find your seat, go on four. You guys can come out and sit right down. So, all right, you may be seated.
All right, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being here on time. Essentially, today we are going to give you some opening instructions. The attorneys are going to give their opening statements. You'll notice there is media in the courtroom. We're going to conduct this trial just like they're not here. That's how we're going to do this. I will assure you that they have been given instructions that not to film you, so you will not be on camera. If somebody sees you on TV, please let me know right away. Sometimes it happens, mistakes are made, but we kind of have a zero tolerance policy here. We don't let that happen, and potentially if they do that, we'll kick them out of here. But it's an open courtroom, and we've allowed them in. But again, you will not be filmed. So just to make sure you know, either coming into the courtroom, leaving, during the proceedings, whatever it may be. So just so you know. All right, with that, members of the jury, you have been chosen to decide a criminal charge made by the state of Michigan against one of your fellow citizens. I will now ask that you stand and swear to perform your duty to try the case justly and to reach a true verdict. If your religious beliefs do not permit you to take an oath, you may instead affirm to try the case justly and reach a true verdict. Here is your oath. Do each of you solemnly swear or affirm that in this action now before the court, you will justly decide the questions submitted to you, that unless you are discharged by the court from further deliberation, you will render a true verdict, and that you will render your verdict only on the evidence introduced in accordance with the instructions of the court, so help you God.
Yes.
All right, records reflect all the jurors have said yes. You may be seated. You will have a written copy of the instructions I'm going to read to you. You may refer to them during the trial. Since no one can predict the course of a trial, these instructions may change at the end of the trial. At the close of the trial, I will provide you with a copy of my final instructions for your use during deliberations. Now I will explain some of the legal principles you will need to know and the procedure we will follow during this trial. A person accused of a crime is presumed to be innocent. This means that you must start with the presumption that the defendant is innocent. This presumption continues throughout the trial and entitles the defendant to a verdict of not guilty unless you are satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt that he is guilty, or she is guilty, excuse me. Every crime is made up of parts called elements. The prosecutor must prove each element of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt. The defendant is not required to prove her innocence or to do anything. If you find that the prosecutor has not proven every element beyond a reasonable doubt, then you must find the defendant not guilty. A reasonable doubt is a fair and an honest doubt, or growing out of the evidence or lack of evidence. It's not merely an imaginary or possible doubt, but a doubt based on reason and common sense. A reasonable doubt is just that, a doubt that is reasonable after a careful and considered examination of the facts and circumstances of this case. The defendant is charged with first-degree felony murder. To prove this charge, the prosecutor must prove each of the following elements beyond a reasonable doubt. First, that the defendant caused the death of Timothy Ferguson. That is, that Timothy Ferguson died as a result of starvation and or physical neglect and abuse. Second, that the defendant had one of these three states of mind. She intended to kill, or she intended to do great bodily harm to Timothy Ferguson. or she knowingly created a very high risk of death or great bodily harm, knowing that death or such harm would be the likely result of her actions. Third, that when she did the act that caused the death of Timothy Ferguson, the defendant was committing or attempting to commit or helping someone else commit the crime of first-degree child abuse. For the crime of first-degree child abuse, the prosecutor must prove each of the following elements beyond a reasonable doubt. First, that Shanda Vander Ark is the parent of Timothy Ferguson. Second, that the defendant either knowingly or intentionally caused serious physical harm and or serious mental harm to Timothy Ferguson. By serious physical harm, I mean any physical injury to a child that seriously impairs a child's health or physical well-being, including but not limited to brain damage, a skull or bone fracture, subdural hemorrhage or hematoma, dislocation, sprain, internal injury, poisoning, burn or scald, or severe cut. By serious mental harm, I mean an injury to a child's mental condition that results in visible signs of an impairment in the child's judgment, behavior, ability to recognize reality, or ability to cope with the ordinary demands of life. Third, that Timothy Ferguson was at the time under the age of 18. The fourth element in first-degree felony murder is that the killing was not justified, excused, or done under circumstances that reduce it to a lesser crime. In determining whether the act causing death occurred while the defendant was committing or attempting to commit or helping someone else commit the crime of first-degree child abuse, you should consider the following: the length of time between the commission of first-degree child abuse and the murder. Second, the distance between the scene of first-degree child abuse and the scene of the murder. Third, whether there is a causal connection between the murder and first-degree child abuse. Fourth, whether there is a continuity of action between first-degree child abuse and the murder. And fifth, whether the murder was committed during an attempt to escape. You may also consider the lesser charge of second-degree murder. To prove this charge, the prosecutor must prove each of the following elements beyond a reasonable doubt. First, that the defendant caused the death of Timothy Ferguson. That is, that Timothy Ferguson died as a result of starvation and or physical neglect and abuse. Second, that the defendant had one of these three states of mind. She intended to kill, or she intended to do great bodily harm to Timothy Ferguson, or she knowingly created a very high risk of death or great bodily harm, knowing that death or such harm would be the likely result of her actions. Third, that the killing was not justified, excused, or done under circumstances that reduce it to a lesser crime. The defendant is charged with the crime of first-degree child abuse. To prove this charge, the prosecutor must prove each of the following elements beyond a reasonable doubt. First, that Shanda Vander Ark is the parent of Timothy Ferguson. Second, that the defendant either knowingly or intentionally caused serious physical harm and or serious mental harm to Timothy Ferguson. By serious physical harm, I mean any physical injury to a child that seriously impairs the child's health or physical well-being, including but not limited to brain damage, a skull or bone fracture, subdural hemorrhage or hematoma, dislocation, sprain, internal injury, poisoning, burn or scald, or severe cut. By serious mental harm, I mean an injury to a child's mental condition that results in visible signs of an impairment in the child's judgment, behavior, ability to recognize reality, or ability to cope with the ordinary demands of life. Third, that Timothy Ferguson was at the time under the age of 18. It is not a crime to discipline a child, a parent, guardian, or any person otherwise allowed by law or authorized by the parent or guardian may use force to discipline a child. But this does not mean that any amount of force may be used. The law permits only such force as is reasonable. The defendant is not required to prove that the acts alleged here were reasonable. The prosecutor must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the force used was not reasonable as discipline. A trial follows this procedure. First, the prosecutor makes an opening statement where he gives his theories about the case. The defendant's lawyer does not have to make an opening statement, but he may make an opening statement after the prosecutor makes his, or he may wait until later. These statements are not evidence. They are only meant to help you understand how each side views the case. Next, the prosecutor will present his evidence. The prosecutor may call witnesses to testify and may show you exhibits like documents or objects. The defendant's lawyer has the right to cross-examine the prosecutor's witnesses. After the prosecutor has presented all of his evidence, the defendant's attorney may also offer evidence. But again, he does not have to. By law, the defendant does not have to prove her innocence or produce any evidence. If the defense does call witnesses, the prosecutor has the right to cross-examine those witnesses. The prosecutor may also call witnesses to contradict the testimony of the defense witnesses. After all the evidence has been presented, the prosecutor and the defendant's lawyer will make their closing arguments. Like the opening statements, these are not evidence. They are only meant to help you understand the evidence and the way each side sees the case. You must base your verdict only on the evidence. What you decide about any fact in this trial is final. My responsibilities as a judge in this trial are to make sure that the trial is run fairly and efficiently, to make decisions about evidence, and to instruct you about the law that applies to this case. You must take the law as I give it to you. Nothing I say is meant to reflect my own opinion about this case. As jurors, you are the only ones who will decide this case. Your responsibilities as jurors is to decide what the facts of the case are. This is your job and no one else's. You must think about all the evidence and all the testimony and then decide what each piece of evidence means and how important you think it is. This includes how much you believe what each of those witnesses said. Part of your job in deciding what the facts of this case are is to decide which witnesses you believe and how important you think their testimony is. You do not have to accept, reject anything a witness says. You're free to believe all, none, or part of any person's testimony. In deciding which testimony you believe, you should rely on your own common sense and everyday experience. However, in deciding whether you believe a person's testimony, you must set aside any bias or prejudice you may have based on the witness's race, national origin or ethnicity, gender identity or sexual orientation, or religion, age, or socioeconomic status. There is no fixed set of rules for judging whether you believe a witness, but it may help you think about the following questions. Was the witness able to see or hear clearly? How long was the witness watching or listening? Was anything else going on that might have distracted the witness? Does the witness seem to have a good memory? How does the witness look and act while testifying? Does the witness seem to be making an honest effort to tell the truth? Or does the witness seem to evade the questions or argue with the lawyers? Does a witness's age or maturity affect how you judge his or her testimony? Does a witness have any bias or prejudice or any personal interest in how this case is decided? Have there been any promises, threats, suggestions, or other influence that may have affected how the witness testified? In general, does the witness have any special reason to tell the truth or any special reason to lie? All in all, how reasonable does a witness's testimony seem when you think about all the other evidence in the case? When it's time for you to decide the case, you are only allowed to consider the evidence that was admitted in this case. Evidence includes only the sworn testimony of witnesses, the exhibits admitted into evidence, and anything else that I tell you to consider as evidence. The questions the lawyers ask the witnesses are not evidence. Only the answers are evidence. You should not think that something is true just because one of the lawyers' questions assume or suggest that it is. I may ask some of the witnesses questions myself. These questions are not meant to reflect my opinion about the evidence. If I ask questions, my only reason would be to ask things that may not have been fully explored. During the trial, you may think of an important question that would help you understand the facts of this case. You are permitted to ask such questions. You should wait to ask questions until after a witness has finished testifying and both sides have finished their questioning. If you still have an important question after this, do not ask it to yourself. Write the question down and either place it directly in the box marked questions in front of you or pass it to another juror who is closer to the box so that they may place it in. Do not show your questions to other jurors. If your question is not asked, it's because I determined under the law that the question should not be asked. Do not speculate about why the question was not asked. In other words, you should draw no conclusions or inferences about the facts of the case, nor should you speculate about what the answer might have been. Also, considering the evidence, you should not give greater weight to testimony merely because it was given in response to a question submitted by a member of the jury. As with everything in this courtroom, if you cannot hear something that is said or presented, or if you cannot see a witness or evidence, please raise your hand immediately. During the trial, the lawyers may object to certain questions or statements made by the other lawyers or witnesses. I will rule on these objections according to the law. My rulings for or against one side or the other are not meant to reflect my opinions about the facts of the case. Sometimes the lawyers and I will have discussions out of your hearing. Also, while you're in the jury room, I may have to take care of other matters that have nothing to do with this case. Please pay no attention to these interruptions. You must not discuss this case with anyone, including your family or friends. You must not even discuss it with the other jurors until the time comes for you to decide the case. When it's time for you to decide the case, I will send you to the jury room for that specific purpose. At that time, you should discuss the case among yourselves, but only in the jury room and only when all of the jurors are present. You must not talk to the defendant, the lawyers or witnesses, or anyone who may be connected to this case. This means that you may not speak to these individuals, even if it has absolutely nothing to do with this case. You should be very cautious about speaking to people because you may inadvertently speak to someone connected to this case. This restriction is necessary to avoid even the appearance of any improper conduct on any person's part. If any person tries to discuss this case with you or in your presence, please tell them to stop. Explain that you're a juror and you are not allowed to discuss the case. If they continue, please leave. Report the incident to the court staff as soon as you return to court. When the trial is over, this restriction will no longer apply, and you may discuss the case with anyone you wish. During the trial, do not read, listen to, or watch any news reports about the case. Do not read, listen to, watch, or participate in any social media in regards to this case. You should consider this a complete ban covering all internet or other broadcast methods. Under the law, the evidence you consider to decide the case must meet certain standards. For example, witnesses must swear to tell the truth, and the lawyers must be able to cross-examine them. Because news reports and social media sources do not have to meet these standards, they could give you incorrect or misleading information that might unfairly favor one side. So, in order to be fair to both sides, please follow this instruction. As you have seen in the back, there are notepads. You may take notes during the trial if you wish. You don't have to. If you do take notes, please be careful that the note-taking does not distract you from paying attention to all the evidence. When you go to the jury room to decide your verdict, you may use your notes to help you remember what happened in the courtroom. If you take notes, do not let anyone except the other jurors see them during deliberations. During our morning, afternoon, and lunch breaks, you will leave your notepads in the jury room. The room will be secured by the bailiff with the notepads inside. Your notes will not be examined by anyone. And when your jury service is concluded, your notes will be collected by Mr. Weaver and will be destroyed. You can see that we have chosen a jury of 14. After you've heard all the evidence and my instructions, we will draw lots to decide which two will be dismissed to form a final jury of 12. As I've indicated before, the possible penalty in this case should not influence your decision. If you find the defendant guilty, it's the duty of the judge to fix the penalty within the limits provided by the law. I may give you more instructions during the trial. After all the evidence has been presented, you will hear the lawyer's closing arguments. Following those closing arguments, I will give you additional instructions about the rules of law that apply to this case. You should consider all of my instructions as a connected series. Taken all together, they are the law that you must follow. After my final instructions, you will go to the jury room to decide on your verdict. A verdict must be unanimous. That means that every juror must agree on it, and it must reflect the individual decision of each juror. It's important for you to keep an open mind and not make any decision about anything in this case until you go to the jury room to decide the case. You must not let bias, prejudice, or public opinion influence your decision. Each of us may have biases or perceptions about other people based on stereotypes. We may be aware of some of our biases, though we do not express them. We may not be fully aware of some of other biases. Take the time you need to test what might be automatic or instinctive judgments and to reflect carefully about the evidence. I caution you again to avoid reaching conclusions that may have been unintentionally influenced by stereotypes. You must reach your own conclusions about this case individually, but you should do so only after listening to and considering the opinions of the other jurors who may have different backgrounds and perspectives from yours. That concludes my opening statements. Mr. Weaver, do we have copies of the... Yeah, can you hand those out, please? You certainly may reference the instructions I've read throughout the trial, but if you do so, make sure it doesn't distract you from the evidence that comes in. It's always a key. As I indicated before, if you can't see something, or the light's too light, you can't see the TV, it's not rude to raise your hand and say, I can't see that. We want you to do that. Mr. Roberts, Mr. Johnson, if you can't see something or you can't hear something, please raise your hand immediately, okay? Okay, with that, Mr. Roberts, you may make your opening statement. Do you want the TV angled? Or?
No, not for
not yet.
No, thank you.
Good enough.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Once again, on behalf of the people of the state of Michigan, I want to thank you for your time and attention to these matters. We certainly had some lighthearted moments yesterday during the jury selection process, and there's nothing wrong with that. But as Mr. Johnson and I repeatedly told you yesterday, and this is not in any way an overstatement of this, the facts and circumstances here are just simply horrific. I wish that I could spare you from some of the details in this case, but I cannot. Quite simply, it is the position of the people of the state of Michigan that Shonda Vander Ark committed the crime of first-degree felony murder when, during the course of physical and mental abuse in the first degree of her child, Timothy Ferguson died. As we referenced many times yesterday, unfortunately, as part of this process, you will see some very graphic photographs, images that will not easily leave your mind. But I don't want you to focus on just those photographs, as I repeatedly told you yesterday. I want you to look at the entire picture here. I will tell you this, the entire picture is just as horrific. The average 15-year-old male weighs 132 pounds and is 68 inches tall. At the time of his death, Timothy Ferguson was right on that average height, 68 inches tall. At the time of his death, Timothy Ferguson weighed 69 pounds. How does this happen? How does a 15-year-old child die as a result of malnutrition? How is a 15-year-old child 63 pounds under the average weight? How is a 15-year-old child in literally the zero percentile for weight? How? The how of this begins to unfold on July 6th of 2022, when police officers from the Norton Shores Police Department are dispatched to 4788 Marshall Road in Norton Shores. The first officer on scene is there. ProMed's already on scene, and they've already found Timothy Ferguson deceased in the basement level of that home. You're going to see photographs of that home. It's a bi-level home, and Timothy Ferguson is in the basement of that home. By the time the officer arrives, Timothy Ferguson is deceased and has been deceased for some time. It's immediately obvious to ProMed, just as it is to Officer Stefanich, who you will hear from this morning, that Timothy Ferguson is severely malnourished. Now, there's another layer of mystery that is discovered the next day as it relates to the cause of death of Timothy Ferguson. And you will hear from the medical examiner that in addition to the severe malnourishment that caused his death, Timothy Ferguson also showed signs of hypothermia. How does a 15-year-old child in Michigan in July have hypothermia? The pieces of that puzzle start to unfold as the police investigation does. Officer Stefanich begins to notice, in addition to the shocking image of Timothy Ferguson, deceased, other things unusual in the home. There's leg cuffs in the basement. There's cameras everywhere. There's hot sauce in the bathroom. Upstairs in the upper level of the home, there's locks on the refrigerator and the freezer. More cameras, motion sensors, alarms, everywhere in the house. And in the basement, as if part of some demented version of Harry Potter, there's a small closet, again, with an alarm on the door. Inside that closet, a blue tarp just laying on the floor in a small box. That room, as officers later come to learn, is called the small room. That was Timothy Ferguson's bedroom. That's where he was forced to sleep. The leg cuffs, also for Timothy Ferguson. The cameras, also for Timothy Ferguson, to watch his every movement. His every movement monitored by his mother on those cameras. The bathroom camera. Who puts a camera in a bathroom? The bathroom camera is literally a motion tracking camera, and the officer notices as soon as he walks into the bathroom that the camera starts to follow his motion. Again, hot sauce in the bathroom. Why is there hot sauce in the bathroom? These are all questions at the time the police officers have, but they have no explanation for most of it. All they know is that Timothy Ferguson died as a result of malnutrition. As is obvious to anybody that would just see him, look at him. So Officer Stefanich starts to ask him questions. And Ms. Van Der Ark says, well, he's been on a hunger strike for the last couple of weeks. He hasn't been eating. And I noticed last night he wasn't eating really good, so I made him some toast with some peanut butter or some butter on it, and I made him eat it, and then he went to bed. And then more detectives become involved in the investigation. And more statements coming out from Ms. Van Der Ark about some of the unusual things in the home. The leg cuffs. Oh, those are Paul Ferguson. Paul Ferguson is the older boy that lives in the house. He's 19 at the time. And you're going to hear from Paul Ferguson. And I'm just going to tell you right now, you're not going to like Paul Ferguson. I don't like Paul Ferguson. Paul Ferguson was a contributing factor to the death of his brother. What you will come to learn is that what Paul Ferguson was the strong arm for the defendant. When she wanted a punishment inflicted upon Timothy, she used Paul to do it. And Paul did it. And he will tell you that he did those things. And he will tell you he is remorseful about those things, as he should be. Because the mental and physical abuse that those two individuals inflicted upon Timothy Ferguson over the course of multiple months, from February of 2022 until the time of his death in July, caused his death. For all intents and purposes, Timothy Ferguson was a prisoner in his own home. He never went to a doctor. He never went to school. The only time he was allowed to leave the house was if he was being punished and he had to run up and down the stairs in the backyard where nobody could see him, or walk the dog in the backyard, again, where nobody could see him. You don't have to take my word for it. You will hear in the text messages between Paul Ferguson and Shonda Van Der Ark the extent of the horrors they inflicted upon Timothy. You will hear about his every movement being monitored by motion sensors and alarms on his body, multiple alarms on his body, cameras watching his every move, making sure he did not go upstairs without permission, making sure he did not go to the bathroom without permission. And when he went to the bathroom, he got 1 minute if he had to pee and 2 minutes if he had to poop. Some of you might already be saying to yourself, this sounds too incredible to be true. Again, you don't have to take my word for it. You will hear the text messages. You will see right there in print, right there before your very eyes, everything that I'm telling you. His access to food denied. Locks on the freezer. Locks on the refrigerator. Alarm on the pantry door. Alarms on the door to the small room where he was forced to sleep. Now, interestingly, when we talk about that alarm on the small room, you're going to see the photographs of that alarm. When the police are there the first day, they take photographs of the scene. And as the investigation progresses, they go back the next day Strangely, that alarm has been removed. The police get the text messages and start to go through the text messages, and a broader picture begins to emerge of what happened to Timothy, especially in those final hours leading up to his death in the early morning hours of July 6th. And what they find is just as shocking as the fact that Timothy died as a result of malnutrition. For roughly the last 9 hours that Timothy Ferguson was alive, he was in an ice bath. First monitored by Paul, and then by Shonda, Timothy Ferguson was forced to lay in an ice bath for 9 hours. Already severely malnourished, already bone thin, forced to be in this bathtub. Again, first monitored by Paul, watched by Shonda from those cameras, and then by her when Paul goes to work. Timothy is too weak to even move on his own volition at that point. That's where the hypothermia comes into play. The medical examiner, puzzled at first, how can there possibly be hypothermia in a child of 15 years old at this time of year? Well, when you spend 9 hours in an ice bathtub, that's what happens. You'll see the ice maker in the home where the ice came from for his ice baths. And again, you don't have to take my word for it. You're going to hear it all in the text messages. And Ms. Vander Ark, again, when she talks to the police, she says, well, Timothy's really, he's just been on a hunger strike for the last 2 weeks. And I didn't know how bad it was getting until last night, and I made him a piece of toast. That's not true. And again, you don't have to take my word for it. On July 13th, almost 3 weeks before Timothy Ferguson passes away, Paul, in a moment of clarity, in a moment of sympathy for his brother, sees his brother without a shirt on and sends his mother a picture. Now, he's already rake thin at that point. Nothing more than skin and bones. And I submit to you, ladies and gentlemen, that any rational human being looking at that photograph would say, oh my God, we have got to do something to help this child. What's Miss Vander Ark's response? Okay, give him some bread. A couple days after that, we learn what the hot sauce is for. Make sure you give him the bread with the hot sauce on it. Make sure he eats 4 slices of bread with hot sauce on it, and if he does that, and waits 30 minutes, he can have some more slices without hot sauce. This is a child who is already essentially on death's door with his malnutrition. And his mother, the person responsible for his care and custody and well-being, is telling her other son to feed him hot sauce. This isn't the only reference to hot sauce. You're going to hear multiple references to it throughout those text messages. At one point, Timothy commits the horrendous crime of eating the crust of a burger, leftover pieces of a burger. And when she finds out, what does she tell Paul Ferguson to do? Go make him throw up. Sadly, Paul does that. Go make him throw up because he ate the crust of a burger. It's difficult to wrap your mind around the level of depraved indifference shown to Timothy Ferguson. And ladies and gentlemen, that is why I will be asking you to return a verdict of guilty of a count of felony murder in the first degree and first degree child abuse. The judge has gone over the elements of that crime, and you have them in your jury instructions, and I won't belabor the point here. But the people's position is that Shonda Vander Ark caused the death of Timothy Ferguson as a result of that malnutrition, as a result of her repeated denial of his access to food during the last months of his life. And that during the course of that time period, she was inflicting emotional, mental, and physical abuse upon him with her actions. And again, you're not going to have to take my word for it. You're going to see the text messages. You're going to hear those text messages. This afternoon, I anticipate that Lieutenant Hoeksema and Detective Ahm will be reading those text messages to you, one playing the part of Paul Ferguson, the other reading Ms. Vander Ark's texts. And like I said, they are shocking. They are truly shocking. Paul's testimony will be as equally shocking. And again, you don't have to like Paul Ferguson. I don't like Paul Ferguson. I hold Paul Ferguson responsible for the death of Timothy Ferguson, just as I do the defendant in this case. But as we talked about in jury selection, it's not for you to decide what happens with Paul Ferguson. He's already made his choice, and he's agreed to cooperate and testify against his mother. And he will be pleading to a first-degree child abuse charge here. His sentence to be determined by Judge Case a little later date. You don't have to like him, but I want you to listen to what he says. Because everything that he says is going to be corroborated by the physical evidence in this case, especially those text messages. He's going to tell you how Timothy Ferguson was a prisoner in that home. When the officers arrived that day, they didn't realize they were walking into a prison cell, but they were. And the horrors they uncovered are horrors not even inflicted upon prisoners of war who get the protection of the Geneva Convention. Horrors we don't inflict on prisoners here in the United States who get regular meals and access to small freedoms. Timothy had none of that. That's the how of this, ladies and gentlemen. That is the how of how Timothy Ferguson died. Now the better question, the harder question, that most of you will likely be asking yourselves is why? When I was in college, I discovered a group, a musical group called 10,000 Maniacs. Their 1987 album, In My Tribe, begins with a song called What's the Matter Here? And it was the first time I remember being aware of socially conscious lyrics for a song. It's a very powerful, very moving song. Natalie Merchant is the lead singer for the group and wrote the song, and the song is about her being a person who's witnessing what she believes to be child abuse, the physical abuse of a child in the building she lives in, and the mental abuse inflicted upon that child by the child's parents. The bridge of the song, after she hears threats made to the child by the father, has these lyrics. Answer me and take your time. What could be the awful crime? He could do at so young an age. If I'm the only witness to your madness, offer me some words to balance out what I see and what I hear. These cold and lowly things that you do, I suppose you do because he belongs to you. And instead of love, you've given him these cuts and sores that don't heal with time or with age. Now, in the song, it's implied that she becomes the person who has the courage to speak up and say what's happening to this child and say, what's the matter here? She can stand up and protect the child. There was nobody that could stand up for Timothy Ferguson. There was nobody that could answer the question, what's the matter here? The defendant made sure that nobody could see Timothy Ferguson. Nobody could see what was being done to him. Can't even produce a picture on her cell phone of him in the last 6 months of his life. I don't know about the rest of you as parents, but you can go 10 photos in my photo stream on my phone without finding a picture of my kids. But nothing in the 6 months leading up to his death. What could be the awful crime he had done at so young an age? I can't answer the why for you. I don't have to answer the why for you. You will hear instructions from the judge that I don't have to prove the motive in this case. And I submit to you, ladies and gentlemen, that no why could possibly, as Natalie Merchant says in the song, no why could possibly justify the cold and lowly things done to Timothy Ferguson. All we know is that they were done. And as a result, Timothy Ferguson died without anyone there to speak up for him, without anyone to say, what's the matter here? So ladies and gentlemen, at the conclusion of these very difficult proofs, I will be asking you to return a verdict of guilty, the charge of first-degree felony murder and first-degree child abuse. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Roberts. Mr. Johnson, do you wish to make an opening statement at this time?
I do.
All right, you may proceed.
You're going to hear, you're going to hear those things. Most of that evidence is not going to be controverted. All of it's going to come in almost exactly like he said it's going to come in. And at the end of the day, you're going to say, what's up?
There's more to come in the trial of Shanda Vander Ark. Here from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast. Stay with us.